The next train to depart from platform 4 is the 1610 First Great Western Service.
Paddington. He was never sure whether he loved or hated it. There was something about stations anyway, a kind of restless, anxious energy. People on the move, partings and reunions. Sometimes it reminded him of a disturbed ant's nest teeming with frantic movement. Airports were the same. The crowds waiting while their train was being prepared, whatever that meant. A quick clean and restocking of crisps and beer, probably. While people stood around like slightly dishevelled athletes, waiting for the starting pistol. Everything was being done for your convenience. Except, that was the last thing it was really done for. Eventually, just before departure time, the train would be ready for boarding. And then there'd be the lemming-like stampede, the level of panic increasing if there'd been a last-minute platform change. Heart attack country, that. Out-of-condition men and women lugging huge wheeled suitcases and trying to run down the platform. Well, once, that is, they'd managed to get past the Gestapo on the gate, listlessly but pedantically checking every ticket. Except now, the virus had changed everything. Masks everywhere, fewer people for fewer trains, and a sense as much of nervous exhaustion as of intent movement. Bring back nationalisation, he thought morosely. Oh, it couldn't be worse than this conveyor belt of money to some foreign owner. He stared at the departure board and scratched his head. He always left London feeling sweaty, hot and grimy, having accreted a fine layer of dirt. If that was on the outside, what must his lungs look like? Still, there was an energy about the place, manic but invigorating. Living there, well, that was quite another thing. In his younger day, it had been affordable, just. Now, a garden shed was beyond most people. Even with the slow collapse of the city as the banks and money men moved their operations to Frankfurt and Dublin. Still, he was travelling first class and would lash out on a restaurant car meal. But first, some freebies in the first class lounge. Paddington was still identifiably Victorian. The lounge even had some wallpaper from the days when the Queen herself had used it. What would she make of it now? Would she have liked the shiny chrome and plastic seats or favoured the leather Chesterfields in the original? How could it be that the Victorians could afford to build so much, so splendidly, when these days it seemed everything cost too much? He'd read somewhere that the country never made any money out of the empire. But Victorian wealth had come from somewhere. A captive market for British goods, he supposed. Plus cheap food and raw materials. He stepped to the side as a rubber-tired electric trolley came down behind him, flashing its orange light and beeping anxiously. He began to move slowly down the side of the station towards the lounge. There were worse places to kill an hour. Free mags, nibbles and drinks. He was in his early 60s and alone. A slight, pale, blue-eyed man with thinning hair, hanging around, waiting without knowing what he was waiting for, or not wanting to face it. When he got there, the lounge was closed to ensure the safety of passengers and staff. His glasses steamed up as he breathed out in exasperation. He'd known the night Riviera's sleeper had stopped running, except for Sundays, but he hadn't thought to check what else was off limits. He had a thought and headed off to Sainsbury's for sandwiches. He had a bad feeling about Pullman dining. It surely would be off too, and it was just too long a journey for crisps and coffee. What did it matter in the scheme of things anyway? I can rough it this once, he thought. Compared with the other changes in his life, making do with a sandwich was hardly life-changing. For as the weeks of COVID had turned into months, and the country's loosest, most careworn bricks had begun to tumble at an ever-increasing rate, as R numbers had been quoted then forgotten, as following the science, world-class and world-beating, had been and gone, while people's lives were shattered or lost, he had decided to leave the city and move to what seemed to be the relative safety of his little holidaylet in the southwest. He could never be called a reckless man. He didn't make life-changing decisions. He liked routine and familiar surroundings, or at least he had. But something had happened to change his thinking, to change him. A neighbour in an adjoining flat had fallen ill. Mr. Hussein had been a neighbour for 10 years and more, living a quiet and calm life with his wife, sometimes having the grandchildren to stay and just toiling away, doing harm to no one. Then Mr. Hussein sat in his driver's seat one day when the air on his bus had been full of droplets and Mr. Hussein had become ill. Then he had died. Grief had descended like endless rain from leaden skies. He'd heard the crying during the day and during the night. Mrs. Hussein, a friendly, smiling and compassionate woman, had seemed to diminish. She shrank and grew fearful. She lost all direction. And he thought, what is the point of all this? There is no longer firm ground. I cannot bear the grief I see. I must leave. I must run away. He was not just confused or saddened. He was adrift in a leaking boat. Like all sick animals, he wanted to be at home. But home was not the place he'd lived in for some 30 years. Home was where he came from. Somehow, he felt, not thought, that he would be all right if he went home. He had had a life of sorts, a career in the civil service after university, relationships, although none for longer than he cared to think about, and no marriage, and no children. Over the years, he'd grown, or more accurately, shrunk, into a calm, unambitious, unemotional man whose life was ordered and organised and safe. The bearded young graduate living with his girlfriend in a tacky bedsit in North London, and then, when she left him, living alone in the same bedsit, and telling himself everything was fine and things would work out, had in time grown a shell, isolated and alone, and, yes, lonely too, he admitted to himself. Now, as he looked back at the turns in the road he'd taken, and looked forward to nothing, he felt hollowed out. He was running away, like the coward I am, he thought. He knew his neighbour's death had been the trigger, not the cause of his panic. He knew, too, he wasn't escaping poverty or deprivation. He was comfortably off. He would rent his London flat, and he'd been able to take redundancy when Cameron's civil service culls had started. Work had filled the week, but he hadn't missed it. He hadn't been able to commit more than his time to his work, as austerity had become the slogan, and mediocre politicians prioritise slash and burn over rational policy in order to climb the greasy pole. He'd learned to keep his ideals securely locked away after a few years of postgraduate radicalism, and eventually had lost the key, and then forgotten all about the cupboard he kept his values in. That had been why she'd left him. She hadn't been ready to compromise beliefs that were part of who she was. He missed her still after all these years, like the part of him that made him whole. They'd lived in a first-floor bedsit in North London, a bedroom come lounge, and then down the corridor to a long room that took a single bed, a kitchenette, and a bath with gas geyser over, which showered limescale into the bath whenever it fired up. The shared loo was downstairs by the front door. They'd painted the walls orange, bought a lot of scented candles, installed a fish tank, and started to build a life together. And then, somehow, life had got in the way. It wasn't their relative poverty in the early years, or the simplicity of their lives. It was, he knew now, his loss of faith. He'd come to believe that they could not change the world, and had become cynical about the value of trying. She had not, and he had been a lead weight holding her back and stifling her spirit as he tried to persuade her that his career was more important than idealistic dreams. One day, when their huge and overweight Armenian landlord, sweating from the climb up a flight of stairs, had given his usual peremptory knock and burst in, he'd found him crying, her note clutched in his hand. Having satisfied himself that the rent would still be paid, Mr. Jack, not his name, but as near as the English could get to Azajorian, he had long ago decided, had shown what was for him unusual delicacy, and left, clearly puzzled that a woman's departure should be so devastating. He had not cried since, having found another secure place to keep his feelings, and again, so he thought, forgotten them altogether, until his neighbour had died, having lived a blameless, and yes, a good life. Pots, she thought, and began clearing away the debris from cooking. The cat flap clattered, and she looked up and smiled. Oh, hello! Where have you been? The cat yowled gently and looked at her expectantly. Hungry, are you? Well, let's see what we've got for you. She measured out a helping of food from the tin, looked at it in the bowl, felt a stab of doubt. Was it enough or too much? She pondered. She put some back in the can, then changed her mind and put it back in the bowl. What a thing to fret about, she thought. The cat waited impatiently. It jumped up on the worktop and she gently put it down again. She did that a lot lately, hesitated, unable to make her mind up, usually about stupid little things. When she went out, if she went out these days, she locked the door, got halfway to the gate and thought, did I lock the door? Turned round, went back to check. Ridiculous, really. Part of growing older, or being alone, she supposed. There you are, then. A perfectly measured portion, more or less. Listen to this, Puss. It's Boccaccio, describing the time of the plague. He writes that a certain sector of society ran away from the sick and bonded together in small groups to entertain themselves with music and whatever other amusements they could devise to avoid the scenes of death in the city. Could be Bournemouth Beach in 2020, not medieval Italy, don't you think? The cat silently agreed. Outside, the birds were singing. Plants and animals were hunkering down for winter. And the world was turning. The moon dragged water across the globe. Creatures were born, and creatures died. Clouds formed, rain fell. Plastic polluted, and fat men with tattoos gave Nazi salutes and drank beer. Police were attacked, and other police attacked. A virus spread, and governments acted and postured. What could she do about all that? What could anyone do? Well, this time she would do something. Go to Greenham, bend the knee. Protest, march, sing. Otherwise, those fat, tattooed men with bellies would win. There ought at least to be a fight. Trouble was, she didn't have much fight left these days. Still, what she had, she would put to good use. It had to be better than watching endless repeats on afternoon telly, along with ads for stairlifts, funeral plans, and equity release. Later, she sat down on the settee and thought about what on earth she could do to make some kind of difference. She was soon joined by the cat, which settled on her lap, purring, as she absently stroked its ear. Politics won't do, she thought. I don't want to be on the inside of a broken system. Of course there are some good people in politics, but they don't often prosper. And some, like Joe Cox.
The thing that surprises me time and time again as I travel around the constituency is that we are far more united and have far more in common than that which divides us.
Lose far more than the chance of advancement. Most people don't feel they have a voice, even if their lot are in power. They're right, too, she said out loud, and the cat opened its eyes briefly and gave a half purr. Remember the anti-Iraq war march, Puss? Well, I don't suppose you do, before your time. Over 1 million people saying to Parliament, please, don't go to war. Made no difference at all. And the 1 million marchers were right. This time around, we clapped the health workers and government offered them a badge, but nothing else. Meanwhile, over the water, the leader of the free world was sowing violence and division in the hope of stealing an election.
We have won this election.
No,
Puss.
Politics won't do it.
There's nothing wrong with saying that, Brad. You know, I mean, the people of Georgia are angry. And these numbers are going to be repeated on Monday night, along with others that we're going to have by that time, which are much more substantial even. And the people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated.
Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong.
Now, do you think it's possible that they shredded ballots in Fulton County? Because that's what the rumor is. And also that Dominion took out machines, that Dominion is really moving fast to get rid of their machinery. Do you know anything about that? Because that's illegal.
This is Ryan Germany. No, Dominion has not moved any machinery out of Fulton County. We're having
Have they moved? Have they have they moved the inner parts of the machines and replaced them with other parts?
No.
You sure, Ryan?
I'm sure.
You should want to have an accurate election. And you're a Republican.
We believe that we do have an accurate election.
No, I know you don't. No, you don't. You don't have. Not even close. You're off by hundreds of thousands of votes. You know what they did, and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal offense. And you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk. But they are shredding ballots, in my opinion, based on what I've heard. And they are removing machinery, and they're moving it as fast as they can, both of which are criminal fines, and you can't let it happen, and you are letting it happen. You know, I mean, I'm notifying you that you're letting it happen. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state. So tell me, Brad, what are we going to do? We won the election, and it's not fair to take it away from us like this. And it's going to be very costly in many ways. And I think you have to say that you're going to reexamine it, and you can reexamine it, but reexamine it with people that want to find answers, not people that don't want to find answers. For instance, I'm hearing Ryan, and I'm sure a great lawyer and everything, but he's making statements about those ballots that he doesn't know. But he's making them with he did make them with surety, but now I think he's less sure because the answer is they all went to Biden. And that alone wins us the election by a lot. You know, so.
Mr. President, you have people that submit information, and we have our people that submit information. And then it comes before the court, and the court then has to make a determination. We have to stand by our numbers. We believe our numbers are right.
Well, under law, you're not allowed to give faulty election results, okay? You're not allowed to do that, and that's what you've done. This is a faulty election result. And honestly, this should go very fast. You should meet tomorrow, because you have a big election coming up. And because of what you've done to the president, you know, the people of Georgia know that this was a scam. And because of what you've done to the president, a lot of people aren't going out to vote. And a lot of Republicans are going to vote negative because they hate what you did to the president. Okay? They hate it. And they're going to vote. And if you would be respected, if really respected, if this thing could be straightened out before the election. You have a big election coming up on Tuesday.